Welcome, everyone, for our next installment of the Book of Esther, Megillat Esther. And I want to do a very short recap. So tonight we are going to literally get down to the mind of Haman and what went through his mind for a genius to make the mistakes that he made. It's very strange. So before we get to that moment, let's just back up. Haman has risen to power. Haman was the one, if you recall, way back in the first chapter, when Queen Vashti doesn't want to come to honor King Ahasuerus, and then she sends the FedEx messenger, basically making fun of the king that you can't compare to my grandfather, King Nebuchadnezzar. Had you lived when he lived, you couldn't have gotten a gig as a stable boy shoveling manure. So the king didn't need to hear that, especially in his, shall we say, adult beverage intoxication, where he was very angry. He calls the Jews. Jews say, Ahasuerus, your royal highness, we don't know what to do. So he calls the seven wise men. Six of them say nothing. They're muted. The seventh one, Haman, who's not identified as such, they call him Mr. Memuchan. He's the least, the seventh of the advisors. And he comes up with the idea that not only did Vashti slight your honor, your royal highness, by not coming, but every male, every man in the 127 kingdoms has now been diminished. Because if a man says to his wife, and remember, this is Persia, okay, way before the suffragette movement. And so the man says, dear, will you, make me some dinner? She's going to say, make you dinner? Well, Ahasuerus was snubbed by Vashti. Make your own dinner. So whatever it's going to be a chaval. It's going to be a horrible situation for the men. So you need to address this, your royal highness. It's not enough for you personally, but for all your royal subjects who are male. And so they send out this insane letter that essentially says every man has to be a man in his own home and rule over the wife. So remember, it's a big thing, huge. Why is it huge? This is the first official communique after almost 3 years of Ahasuerus' rule as the new king. And they're waiting with bated breath. You can imagine having the Pony Express deliver an official communique from the king, and there's a little wax seal with a signature ring. Right? When your name is Ahasuerus Nebuchadnezzar, you commit all signatures to signet rings. So you think this is a big deal. And then they open it up and say, what? He wants us to be a man over and rule over his wife? Is our king a fool? Like, what? What? So they kind of toss the letter away, thinking the guy's an idiot. I already rule my wife. What's the issue here? But there were only two communiques ever issue formally in the name of the king. The first was this, communicate to be a man and rule your wife. And of course, the second was the one that Haman sends, kill the Jews. Because the first one was so dumb that people don't react to the second one and they don't in advance say, let's just kill the Jews and not wait for Adar. Let's just kill them. We don't like them anyways. No, they said, wait a minute. Is this the same idiot who sent out that first communique years ago? Okay, fine. You know what? He'll change his mind. If it happens, great, we'll wait. But we're not in advance going to get up and kill the Jews now. We'll wait. And that gave Esther and Mordecai the opportunity to intervene and to send out a clarification mail that would address this situation. Okay, so what happens? The next day, Vashti is now dead, gone, banished. She was gorgeous outside, but black and dark inside. And the king misses her. He has been emasculated, so he can't have a real relationship. And we spoke about how, unfortunately, as children, you're all, you know, you dress your little girls up as princesses and, you know, little Princess Esther, and there everyone's trying out to be the new queen. It wasn't very nice because the king could not have a relationship with a real woman. After Vashti undermined him in such a profound way and embarrassed him, he can't have a real relationship. So what happened? What type of a relationship does he have? He has a relationship, essentially, with a concubine. So what do? All of the women who are chosen by his men from the 127 kingdoms, they're brought against their will if necessary. They audition one night, and then they're thrown into the harem unless he asks for them by name. Essentially, he prostitutes hundreds of young women. We don't read this, of course, the night that we dress up as our little daughters as Esther, but it was a horrible thing. It was a kind of a state-sanctioned rape fest. It's really dark. But Esther, again, taken against her will, it was coercion. She's brought, she doesn't want any to be farpitzed. Anyone know Yiddish here? Farpitzed, Rina's laughing. Farpitzed means when you get all made up and ready, dressed to the nines, you would say in English, right? You're farpitzed. So she's all farpitzed, like everyone else, and she says, no, I don't want to be farpitzed. I'll go as I am. And her humility, her uniqueness, attract her to Achashverosh. She's not the cookie-cutter young lady. And in fact, she finds favor, like an Olympic athlete. We spoke about this in a previous class. I know nobody watched the Olympics. I personally boycotted them. When the Uyghurs are freed, I watch the Olympics again. Okay. I don't have a Nike deal. Maybe I would watch the Olympics if I had a Nike deal. That was a joke. Okay. But in all seriousness, I actually think it's disgusting that we worry about real slavery from 150 years ago, which was demonic, but it was 150 years ago. There's actual people in a concentration camp right now over in China, and they're Muslims, and they're innocent people, and they're making parts for our phones and for our shoes blindfolded. Their women are raped and incarcerated, and they're kept in camps. And the world somehow says, oh, this is okay. We can legitimately go for a Chinese-sponsored Olympic Games. I ask you if this is normal, okay? Anyway, just throwing that out there, just sort of incidentally, that's my own little politics at play. I feel for the humans,
Mark,
over there.
What kind of food did we have tonight?
Kosher American Chinese food. Mm-hmm. But it was not sponsored. As far as I know, Emperor Xi did not sponsor tonight's talk. But you're right. Good point. The attorney is weighed in. Thank you,
Ben.
That was very clever. Very clever. That was brilliant. That was brilliant. That was sneaky. All right. Barry said, excuse me, Rabbi, we're talking about China. What type of kosher food did we have tonight? You're right. Maybe we should boycott all the kosher Chinese food. No, chas v'shalom. Okay. You can do a lot of things to the Jews. Okay? You can butcher us. You can attack us. You can malign us. You can, you know, everything bad. If you go after our food, the buck stops there. Right? You go after our Chinese food, forget it. Forget it. We're all in. The Jews are united, right? Gastronomic Judaism. Okay, so let's get back to the story. So Esther does not want to be Esther, but she's chosen. She's given one directive by Mordechai, her cousin. According to many opinions, they were married. He was older than her, yes, but he adopted her. She was orphaned, never knew her mother and dad. They were married, and it was a great sacrifice that she should live with the king. So the rabbis addressed her situation because she's a married woman. How can she essentially stay married if she is with the king in that way? So the answer is that it's coercive. It becomes non-coercive later on, as we will see. When she goes to the king willingly, she basically says, you know that if I go willingly, I'm not permitted to you for the rest of our lives. Our relationship is over, she says to Mordechai. So we'll touch on that. It's a sad situation for Esther. You know why? Even after the story's over and we win the day, she has to remain married to Achashverosh. She gave up a lot. Like, there's no happy ending for poor Esther at the end. We ignore this, right? Because, great, Haman loses, we win, Baruch Hashem, we sing, everything's great. Esther gave up everything for the Jewish people. So it's a very sad story. Maybe that's why it's the Megillat Esther, to remember an homage to who she was and her sacrifice. Okay, what happens? So Esther becomes like the Olympic athlete. Everyone loves her. She had a very sort of greenish olive skin, which made her closely resemble 127 provinces and countries. Because remember, the kingdom, the Persian-Babylonian kingdom, extended from Ethiopia in Africa all the way to Hodu, which is India. Okay, so there's a lot of people who look like Iranians or East Indians, whatever, and they all have a certain complexion. So everybody, when they looked at Esther, because she didn't divulge her genetics, she didn't take the Ancestry.com test, she kept it quiet. It was her personal secret. We'll talk about that tonight in great detail. She was sort of like the poster girl for every culture. So every culture secretly thought, she's one of us. She's one of ours. And you know what it's like, right? Israel doesn't have a lot of great Olympic athletes. I mean, ever since Munich, honestly, I don't even know why Israel bothers sending people to the Olympic Games after the massacre. And what do they have, a day and a half of mourning? And then the guy announced, the games must go on. Somehow, if that was any other nation, I don't think the games would have gone on. Jews killed in Germany by terrorists, the games got to go on, right? It was very brutal, if you remember, 1972 Munich. But be that as it may, we all know that there's a pride we feel. If you're an American and a USA athlete, you know, the young women, the gymnastics, whatever, the champions, there's a pride that we feel in them. or if there is even better, a Jewish American athlete, or even better, an Israeli athlete, right? We feel a sense of nachas. Oh my gosh, it's one of our people, right? So that's how everybody felt about Esther. They didn't know that she was a Jewess. They didn't really know who she was. But that's the whole point. So she found favor in everyone's eyes. Her Rasmussen poll numbers were off the charts. They loved her. So what happens? So then we spoke about how there was a plot to kill the king. The plot was written in the Book of Chronicles. There are actually two books that we'll find out about, but another day. And in one of the books, it's recorded that Mordechai did it. In the other book, Mordechai is redacted. The sons of Haman had access to it. They took some white out, and guess whose name they filled in instead of Mordechai's? Haman! So when it was read in front of Ahasuerus, who saved his life and the plot of the two disgruntled bodyguards, Bigson and Seresh, it said Haman was the one who informed the king about the plot. So he never rewards Mordechai until the moment that we need the reward to happen, which will be a class that we're going to have, please God, next week. So what happens? So you look on page 21, which I know that we don't have the page numbers at home. This is where he throws the lottery, comes out with Adar, the month that we celebrate Purim in. And then he goes to the king, and this is what we did last week. Haman and the king have a very delicate conversation. You see, Haman can't come out and say to the king, I want you to become Adolf Hitler. The king doesn't want to be known as Vladimir Putin. I mean, whatever, right? He doesn't want to be known as some tyrant who wiped out a whole bunch of people. So, and Haman knows this. So Haman is very delicate. He doesn't ever say in the Megillah, I want you to kill the Jews. He says, no, Your Royal Highness, there's this nation. They're separate. They don't uphold the laws of the country. If you, Your Royal Highness, would be drinking wine out of a goblet, and you handed that goblet to a Jewish rabbi, he'd throw it away. He wouldn't drink it because you drank from it. If a fly lands in that goblet of wine, he could take the fly out and drink the wine. That's how little the Jews hold you in esteem. It's a kosher rule, but that's besides the point. So Haman sort of tiptoes on the periphery. Does Ahasuerus know what he's talking about? Of course. It's all a game, but it's a political game. Remember, Ahasuerus is a politician. He's the world's first great master politician. And so Haman says, look, I have 10,000 talents of silver. I'll put them in the royal treasury, right? He's bribing the king. Just sell them to me. I could take care of it. Not a problem. So what happens? The king thinks about it. He says, you know, Haman, here's my ring. Gives him his signet ring. He says, you write the letter, send out the letter in my name. And by the way, the money, keep it. This is on me. And so Ahasuerus sits down, and you can see the picture on page 23. I'll hold it up. It's a picture of Ahasuerus and Haman delightfully drinking and making merry the night that they come to the agreement to build Auschwitz-Birkenau and massacre and kill all the Jews. Okay? And we pointed out last week, and this is how we're going to end, that, I mean, the summary, then we get to page 13 now. The summary, we end with the idea that the act of the king taking his signet ring off his hand and handing it to Haman and saying, Haman, do as you wish with the Jews. That brought more Jewish people back to Judaism than any single act in the history of our people. I have to say this, tragically, when there is peacetime, like for example in Israel, we all fight. This one doesn't get along with that. Have you seen how dysfunctional the Israeli parliament is, what they call the Knesset? I mean, it's a very dysfunctional organization. Okay? We don't get along. But when there's a terrorist attack, when a couple of our yeshiva boys are kidnapped by Hamas, we fight wars. We come together as one. And how tragic is it that we can't come together during simcha times, joyful times? Why do we have to wait for painful times to come together? And the same thing is true in America. I will never forget the day after 9/11, 9/12. You remember, it was amazing to be in the United States of America. There was nothing I've ever experienced like it. You were hugging firemen and kissing policemen. And remember, everyone was wearing the FDNY hats and the NYPD hats because these men were running up burning towers instead of literally exiting the building. I mean, they were the biggest heroes ever. And somehow all of that was just forgotten over time, right? Time heals, but time also we forget. So it's tragic that we have a tendency to get together in times of peril, in times of stress, but we have yet to sort of master getting together when we don't eat. And the Jews here are no different. Boy, do they get together when they find out about the letter. So that's where we're up to, okay? So please now let's begin with chapter 4, Perek Dalet. And you see that Mordechai is made aware. The rabbis have a lot to say. How did he find out about the letter? And you can see him on this picture. I'll hold it up for everyone online. Mordechai is wearing sack ve'efer. This is Mordechai. He's wearing sackcloth and ashes. And all the Jewish people are gathered in Shushan, the capital. And they're likewise on page 24, 25. Everyone is dressed sack ve'efer. And they're all mourning and they're all saying Tehillim, Psalms. Everyone is up in arms because they heard. Now, the letter was brilliant. You ready for the letter? Brilliant letter. In the same way that Haman is scared to identify overtly the Jewish people as being the source of his wrath and extermination dream, the letter doesn't say, kill the Jews. I'll read it to you. It's actually in the Megillah, okay? And people often overlook this, okay? Listen to this. Listen to the words. You ready? This is what the letter said. The contents of the letter were as follows. I'm reading from page 23. This law should be announced in every country for all the nations to know that they should be ready to fight on that day, the day being the 13th day of the Jewish month of Adar. The swift messengers left in a great hurry, and then they proceeded to destabilize and to send out that letter everywhere, making Jews everywhere freak out. But it didn't mention Jews, and it didn't even mention what's going to happen on that day. It said, be prepared. Be prepared for what? Ah, you see, there were two levels to the letter. There was the public letter that was nailed up in the town square of every little village and every little place in the 127 kingdoms. And that simply said, be prepared for this day to do the king's work. And then, wink, 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 there was the oral part of the command. And the oral part of the command was disseminated by Haman to his Haman lovers. So anyone who loved the Amalekites, and there were a bunch of followers of his apparently all throughout the kingdom, right? So you had all these wacko neo-Nazis everywhere in the 127 kingdoms, and they understand what the letter means. They're reading between the lines, and they are galvanizing themselves and preparing to exterminate the Jews. But yet, the king has a layer of protection, right? We say deniability. Famously, how many presidents have ever turned to their, the White House chief of staff or the, national security advisor, the secretary of state, secretary of defense, and said, look, get it done, but don't tell me the details. Just do it. So then when the president is called on, let's say things fail, right? The president could say, what? I didn't know about this, right? Nobody told me. I didn't know that this was going to happen, right? It happens all the time. And the president legitimately could say, oh, look, I didn't know the details. So Ahasuerus, right? Right, with the AP reporters yelling out, or the Fox News or CNN guy, hey, King Ahasuerus, how could you send such a letter out to exterminate your own population? He could say, what are you talking about? The letter never said anything about killing the Jews. Haman, I'm surprised, I'm shocked that you could have been just such a duplicitous individual. I mean, I could have figured out from the stupid hat that you wear, not the triangle hat. But see, there's always that veneer of deniability that politicians like to build around themselves. That's exactly what Ahasuerus. Now, you might say, how is that important? Do you know why it's important? Because it's brilliant. Think about it. Later on, Esther and Mordechai are told, the letter's been sent. You can't retract the letter. It's a rule. When the king sends out an official edict, a rule, a law, that's it. That's all she wrote, folks. So Esther and Mordechai said, but your Royal Highness, we don't have to change it. We don't have to revoke it. We need to explain it. So Ahasuerus is probably not the swiftest guy. And Esther says, look, all we have to do is send out an explanatory letter in your name. And she has the king's signet ring now, right? What does the letter say? You know that day that I said to be prepared to fight? Amalek, Haman's fan club, they're the people that the king has always wanted to target in every kingdom. So this letter empowers the Jewish people and the lovers of the Jews to rise up in every single village and town where they are and to take revenge against their would-be assassins. You see, in other words, the ambiguity of Haman's letter allows a sort of a second letter to sort of tweak the first one and ultimately undermines it. So it's brilliant. In other words, his fear of overtly killing Jews comes back to destroy him. Okay. So what is the response? So we said at the beginning of Perek Dalet, the Jews are all wailing, and then Mordechai and Esther come, and they go back and forth in this amazing dialogue. The dialogue is not face-to-face. It's via messenger. But the emissaries come back and forth. Okay? So Mordechai basically says to the queen, look, my dear, only Hashem, only God himself knows, how come you were chosen to be the queen? Now, it's been 9 years. The facade, oh, I will not tell you my identity. I mean, I don't even know how she did it, but for 9 years, she hasn't revealed her Jewish heritage as a Jew. Okay. 9 years. But maybe this is the reason you were chosen. Maybe this is why your life has been shattered and my life has been shattered. Maybe this is the moment. We don't know. Could be. Maybe that's why you were God's secret plan. We don't know. And you know what Esther says? I hear you. But I got a problem. You see, Haman's not an idiot. And Haman knows that the Jewish lobbyists are going to assault the king. When word gets out, the oral word of what the intent of that letter really is about, that he's building gas chambers to kill all the Jews, you know what the Jews are going to do. AIPAC and all those annoying organizations are going to come lobby Ahasuerus to change his mind. So what does Haman do? Brilliant. He makes the king into a paranoid lunatic, dropping little hints here and there. And so the king is now withdrawn his public duties, and he is sequestered alone in the inner sanctum of his chambers, doing daily boring stuff, but not with a public presence. So how do I get to the king? You know, Esther says back to Mordechai, if I barge in without an invitation, and I haven't seen him for more than 30 days, so for all I know, my stock has dropped in his eyes. Maybe he doesn't care for me anymore. And if I barge in, it doesn't matter who you are or what your station in life is, it's off with the head. We kill you and ask questions later. They'll kill me. The only way I won't be killed is if the king takes notice of my plight, lifts up his Sharvit HaZahav, his golden scepter towards me, then I'm saved. But wait a minute, Mordechai. So you're asking me to risk my life to go see the king. Okay, fine. Let's walk through this for a moment. So I'm trying to really get you in the mind of Esther and Mordechai. Okay? Let's take this to its royal conclusion. Okay, I'm barging in. Okay, great. So what's the best outcome? That the king will take note of me, he'll lift up the scepter, spare my life, and say, come on over. So my life was just saved. So what, am I supposed to double down? Oh, Your Royal Highness, you know, I'm not, how do I say this, Your Royal Highness? You know, I'm not like a pig. I don't want to take too much for myself, but I know you just spared my life. Great. But can you also spare the lives of my family and my nation? Like, how do I do that? In other words, he may turn to me and say, look, Esther, shut up. I just spared your life, sweetheart. Be happy. Go home. Go back to your palace. So then I have to say, we'll spare everyone else. The king's not going to go there. So this is not an opportune moment, because in other words, it's forcing me to use up my financial capital, if you will, that I've accrued over the years of our relationship, just to get off with my life. And now you're asking me to, at the same moment, to double down and say, oh, by the way, it's not enough that my life is spared. You got to spare all the Jews' lives. Really? You think Akash is going to react to this in a positive way? So it's a very good, legitimate point that Esther's making. And then Mordechai sends back to her the next communique. I believe the next communique is the most brilliant, devastating communique ever. Ever. Okay? Read with me. This is now Perek Dalet for those who are following at home. That's the fourth chapter. And we're going to go to verse 13, Yud Gimel. We're on page 27 now, where it says, they told Esther's words to Mordechai. Okay? So Mordechai basically has just been informed of Esther's argument. How can I go and in addition to sparing my life, then ask the king, hey, you know, what about the lives of my people, right? So Mordecai hears this, and then he responds. His response teaches us about the nature of our world in such a profound way. I'm going to share it with you right now. Ready? But let's do the English. Ready? Then Mordecai said to answer to Esther. This is all done via messenger. Do not think, Mordecai says to Esther, that you, Esther, have a better chance than the rest of the Jews to escape in the king's palace. For if you stay quiet at a time like this, relief and rescue will come to the Jews from some other place. But you and your father's house will die. And who knows, Esther, maybe it was just for a time like this that you became queen. Wow. Now I'm going to pick it apart. You're going to see where this is going. So in other words, Mordecai says, look, Esther, listen to these words. We don't need you to go to the king. You need to go to the king for you, not for us. What does that mean? That's what he said. He said, if you don't go, the Jews are going to be rescued from another place. We don't know where that is, but I promise you, sweetheart, he says to Esther, the future of the Jewish nation doesn't rely on you, Esther, and whether you have the courage or not. So don't go. No, don't go. But if you don't go, it comes at a personal loss to you. Not only to you, but to your family, to your father. What is Mordecai talking about? What does this mean? Okay, listen to this. This is a Band-Aid moment, right? If you have extra Band-Aids, tape up your head so your brain will not explode. Okay? I promise you, this is one of those moments. Okay, listen to this. The survival of the Jewish people at any one moment cannot possibly rest on any one individual person. No matter how wonderful that person is, and Esther is an amazing person, what a sacrifice she gave for her people. But what if Esther just doesn't go? Like, what if at the end of this back and forth exchange, Esther says, I'm not going. So you know what Mordecai says? Fine. We'll live. You won't, but we will. What does that mean? So I believe it means the following. There are two levels to how our world operates. There's the human individual level, what we call freedom of our choice to make choices. And then in the larger universal realm, there are events that are going to happen because God has ordained that they will happen. The individuals who will bring about the event and the results, oh, well, that's open for a roll call. The casting hasn't finished. So in other words, Esther's being told by Mordecai, my dear, you need to do this for you, for your legacy, which I'll explain in a moment what it means. We don't need you to go. Fine, don't go. So in other words, in each and every generation, there are universal moments that are going to happen. I'll cite a famous one, okay? Do you remember the story of how Moshe Rabbeinu and Moses dialogues around the bush, right? We call it beating around the bush with God. He spends, listen to this, 7 days debating with God about whether Moses should be the one to go free the Jewish people, right? What happens at the end? Finally, Moshe goes. Moses goes. We know the rest of the story. What if Moses didn't go? What, the Jews don't get out of Egypt? Of course they do. But what happens to Moses? He's a footnote in history. We don't even know who Moses is. Charlton Heston will not exist, my friends. Well, it's not sure. He did Ben-Hur. He was pretty good. Okay. But the bottom line is, if Moses argues too long and pushes the envelope, someone else will step in to be the Redeemer. It just won't come through Moses. The same thing here. If Esther won't go, the Jewish people are not going to die at the hands of Haman. It's not the destiny that God has woven into the fabric of creation. In other words, nature dictates that the Jews are going to win. There's going to be a Purim, there's going to be a miracle. Whether it happens through Esther and Mordecai, okay, it's an open question. We don't know yet. Maybe yes, maybe no. That's what Mordechai is trying to teach Esther. You need to go because this is your moment. This is why God perhaps selected you and you alone. You're in a unique position to do what needs to be done. But if Esther, at the end of the day, you don't go, the Jewish people will have relief and saving for somewhere else. So I want you to think about something. How many times in Jewish and human history have people chickened out and not done the right thing? In other words, if Esther doesn't go, are we sitting here learning the book of Esther? Of course not. Is there a holiday of Purim? Of course not. So what happened in the end of the story? I'm glad you asked. In my alternative universe where Esther doesn't go, you know what happens? One of the Huns comes. I don't know if they really lived at this time, but I'm just going to pick one out, okay? Genghis Khan comes. And Genghis Khan's not a happy guy when he meets Ahasuerus. He sacks the kingdom, kills, of course, Ahasuerus, the queen, and everyone else, including Haman as his viceroy, his prime minister. And you know that letter that was sent out to kill the Jews 10 months, 11 months from now? Who cares, right? The Huns have now ruled the world. They don't care about some Jewish edict. So the Jews are saved. But they're not saved through Esther and Mordechai. They're saved in a generic way. We don't even know that there was like this plight. It won't even come up. It's not part of Jewish history. So I'm asking, how many times in Jewish history have the would-be Esther's not gone to the king because we just chickened out? I don't want to go. It's not me. I'm not doing this. And the tragedy is, as they say in that great movie On the Waterfront, we could have been a contender, could have been someone. Every one of us has, on a smaller scale, little things that are uniquely ours. In our lives, we have been gifted moments in time. God willing, they're not going to be like an Esther moment where you have to give up your husband and you have to give up your life, essentially, for the Jewish people. But they're small, micro moments. And those moments are yours and mine, and they don't belong to anyone else. But what happens if you chicken out? What happens if I don't get up that day? I have a headache and I don't go. Okay, it will still work out for the Jews, yes. But guess what? It won't come through the hands of Kaplan. I won't have anything to do with it. My moment that was mine and mine alone, I will have passed over that moment. So do you hear it? It's an amazing idea. In other words, our universe behaves two ways. There's the personal choice that Esther has to make for herself and her people. And then there's the universal decision that God already made, the big thing. The Jews will beat Haman in the end. Haman doesn't win the day. Jews will live. So it's on two different levels, right? So in other words, people often ask, well, if there's divine providence and God rules the world, where do I step in? I just proved it to you. We all have an opportunity from time to time to partner with God to do something small, maybe something big, on behalf of ourselves or the Jewish people or our world. Okay? What those moments are yours and yours alone. I don't know. But all I know is this. If you forgo that moment never comes back. And if you forgo that moment, it could be a loss. That's why every moment, as I say, carpe diem, seize the day. Because it could be yours. And that could be the reason you live. We don't know. We're always focused on something that we think is what we are tasked to do. And sometimes Hashem, God says, he taps you on your shoulder sometimes and says, you know, you're looking the wrong way, Rabbi. Actually, you know, you're looking over here, over there. You know that person who rang your doorbell 3 minutes before Shabbos and needs some help? I know it's inconvenient right now to help him. This is the reason I brought you to Wilkes-Barre, not all the other stuff that you did. Great. Mazel tov, you gave a couple interesting classes, you helped people. This is the reason I want you to help. This is why you're here for this moment. Now, Esther's is very profound, okay? Hopefully ours won't get in that vicinity. Now, let's talk about her family and why it's Esther. Okay, listen to this. Mordechai says, and I'm going to repeat it. If you stay quiet, Esther, at a time like this, relief and rescue will come to the Jews from some other place, but you and your father's house will die. What is that all about? You ready for this? Esther is royalty. She is a descendant of the first Jewish king, King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. He was the king right before David HaMelech, before King David. It didn't end well for Saul. He disobeyed God twice in very overt ways. You know what happened to Saul? He lost his kingdom. He, his precious son John, Jonathan, Yonatan, who was best friends with David, They were murdered in a very, very tragic way by the Plishtim, by the Philistines. Now, what was the real big sin that King Saul did? You want to guess? He allowed the king of Amalek, Agag, he didn't kill him. He let him live for a day. He took him prisoner after waging war against the Amalekites. But the king, he put him like a cage and put him in chains. He brought him to present him in front of the people. So when the prophet Samuel arrives and there's Agag, the king still alive, Samuel's like, what are you doing? You disobey God. And he says, no, we're going to take care of him. You know, he's in chains. So what does Agag do? Unbeknownst to Saul, unbeknownst to Samuel, unbeknownst to everybody but God, he impregnates his wife right before he died. He wasn't supposed to be allowed to do this. Saul delayed in his execution. That delay creates Haman. Because Haman is described to us as Haman, the son of Medata, the Agagite. Why is he described as an Agagite? Because he is the great, 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 great grandson of King Agag, king of the Amalekites. Who messed up and allowed King Agag to have conjugal relations with his wife and to allow Haman to be born? It was King Saul. Who is King Saul's great, 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 great granddaughter? Esther! So in other words, multi-generationally, Esther now has this amazing opportunity to save her great Zadie. Her great grandfather Saul's soul is waiting in heaven with this blight of the sin on his soul that he allowed Haman to be born. And it's Esther and Esther alone who can undo and rectify what her great great Zadie didn't do. So that's what Mordechai is saying to Esther. Esther, it's not just about you, sweetheart. Ubei Savich, it's about your father's house. Your great-great-grandfather, Saul, his soul, his neshama is waiting in heaven. You're the only person who, if you bring Haman down, you rectify Saul's mistake. That's so awesome, because we are all the dreams and the hopes of our grandparents and our great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents. And what we do or don't do directly impacts the souls of our loved ones in heaven. Think about it for a moment. If your genetics are this amazing combination, going back to Mount Sinai, everyone who came before you is sort of like looking down, it's kind of a scary thought, and cheering you on and saying, come on, do it, go to the king. Come on, Esther, you can do this. They're your cheering section. They're wearing like, you know, jerseys and hats with you on them. They're saying, come on. There's the door. 2 minutes for Shabbos. Come on, give them some tzedakah. Help that person up. This is why you were created. Come on, Kaplan. They're cheering you on. Do it, right? And they're sitting there with their popcorn and they're watching you on high def, right? And they're cheering you on. And you can sometimes even hear their voices. When you do the right thing, there's that sense of, you know, historical connection. So this is what Esther is doing right now. She is closing the circle. That circle that goes from Agag, Saul, to Haman, Esther, is unique. And it's hers and hers alone. So if she drops the ball, what happens to Saul? He's gone. He's done. Wow. So you see how nuanced Mordechai's message is. So let's end with this following idea. Okay? Next week, we're going to delve into the mind of Haman. Tonight, I just wanted to keep it focused on Esther. So let's just leave with the following, okay? The rest of your lives, God willing, ad me'ev eshrim to 120, don't let the small things go. Think about Esther. That should be the ultimate message to each and every, I'm including myself, I'm right up there on that list, okay? We don't know what moments will not only define us, or say more than define us. Those moments are the reason God created us into this world. And there are moments that are gifted to us. It's not always a singular moment in time. It could be. More likely, there are little moments that we can do certain things. And we know what they are, usually. And probably they're the things that are a little bit out of your comfort zone. I'm just guessing. If it's a little too comfortable for you, it's probably not the Esther-like challenge that she faced, right? But at the end of the day, if we will keep in mind the Sauls of our own world, and who's waiting there to be legitimized through our actions or inactions, and what that means to us, our parents, our grandparents, going all the way back, it changes the whole focus. Right? So in other words, will things still work out 100%? God ordained it. At the end of the game, we're going to get to that point. The Messiah will come. We'll get to the end. Ah, but there's a casting call right now. And that casting call is looking for qualified Jews and Jewesses to fulfill, I like that word, Jewesses. I don't know if it's a real word, but it sounds like a real word. Qualified men and women of the Jewish faith. There's a casting call right now because our world is upside down. Okay, our world feels very much like a Purim's type story where up is down and down is up and Haman's ruling the world and where does, like, all, it's nightmare, right? If you're a Jew, you know, none of it makes sense. And maybe when the Megillah is published afterwards and you read the story and you go, holy smokes, all that stuff took place, palatial intrigue, and I didn't even know about it. I mean, how would the average Joe or Jane on the street be privy to the all the will of Esther, Mordecai, Haman, all the duplicity and all the heroism? Nobody knew till after the fact, right? I promise you, our world probably feels the same way to you and to me. It does, right? We're deluged every day with information, information, information. At the end of the day, all we can do is seal it off, look at our families, look at the things that matter, and prioritize those choices that we make and the impactful nature of what our next choice is going to be. I wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom.